Okay, so today I'm in Somerset, High Hole Worthy Farm with trainer Jeremy Scott. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Jeremy. So it's you and your wife Camilla that train up here. Have you got a racing background?
Not specifically. Camilla was more involved in racing when she was, before we got married, she was involved in the bloodstock industry in London in insurance. So, but we, you know, we both grew up around horses and always had an interest in racing rather than family connections.
Okay, so what facilities do you have in the yard? How many horses could you cater for?
I think we're licensed for 36. We've got accommodation for various others, so resting horses. We've got all our own grazing because we're a farm. And to train on, we've got a sort of half-mile all-weather gallop, a schooling ring, horse walkers and, you know, the normal bits and pieces that most trainers have.
Okay, it's a proper family run business. Laura, your daughter's a head girl. Do you think is that important, you know, for the sort of fabric of a yard to be a tight knit?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I think it's very much family. And my older daughter who works for Eve Johnson Horton as assistant, you know, even she's still very involved in it, so she would do a lot of the social media stuff for us as well. So it's always been a family thing. It's, you know, when we started up, one of the reasons we did it was because it was something we could do as a family.
Okay, now you started, you had your first runner in 1992, it was at Training Point to Pointers, and the yard is a 370 acre dairy farm. So why, you know, what was the original? Were you big point-to-point fans? Is that why you decided to have a crack yourself?
We're always into the pointy. I mean, indeed, I had a couple of bad rides point-to-pointing when I was very young. So we were always interested in that respect. But as much as anything, it was just to get us off the farm. We had a friend who was interested. She'd come back from America. She'd been working in racing over there. We bought a thoroughbred that we wanted to hunt, really, and she decided that we should train it. So that's how it started, with one mare. Got our first winner, and then we were pretty well hooked.
Okay, so you're husband and wife team. Do you have your separate roles and expertise, or is it a sort of, how does it work?
Well, Camilla's a Cinderella, so she's always at home. Constant in the yard along with Laura, so they, between the two of them, and Laura's doing much more of it now, so Laura would now be doing the list in terms of what the horses are doing, and it's discussed between the three of us, but really Camilla and Laura are the team at home that make sure that everything runs smoothly, the horses are properly cared for, you know, the staff are looked after, and that any problems that they've got, you know, they can address them. I'm sort of flitting around, going racing, watching horses doing their work and whatever. So although my name is on the piece of paper, you know, I'm the kind of jack of all trades, whereas actually the really important people are the two that stay at home, keeping an eye on, making sure it's all working.
Okay, is the race course experience something you enjoy?
It's great when it goes well. No, I mean, the actual racing's fine. I mean, the travelling is, for us, is the real bane. You know, Taunton, Exeter, Newton Abbot, perfect. You know, once you go beyond Cheltenham, I mean, you're talking over 3 hours. So it's an awful chunk of your day gone when you go racing, and I always feel it's very important. If you've got an owner that's going racing, I should be there to make sure their race day experience is as good, hopefully, as it could be. So yeah, if we're regularly racing, you know, I'm not here very much, so, which is why it's so important to have a good team at home, making sure it's all happening.
Okay, when I was doing my research on you, I was quite intrigued to read that, and I quote, you rode a few to understand what jockeys were talking about. Was that horses or races, or are you talking about the point-to-point experience?
Oh, I know. Well, when I was 16, there was a gang of us boys, and we all knew each other. We decided we'd just go in the hunt race for a bit of a giggle. So that was my first experience. And we were literally on ponies. But we all survived. And then after we'd been training pointers for a while, we had actually quite a nice young horse that I thought it would be a good idea, again, just to ride in the hunt race pointing. Just so that I had some idea of what is going on in a race. Because the easiest thing is to bollock the jockey for getting it wrong. And actually, if you're not doing it from a point of having some idea of what is going on, it's probably not really fair. So yeah, I did. I had a spin very badly, but I certainly got a better understanding of what goes on in a race and how little time you have to make a decision. And that decision can be critical, and we can watch it on the telly and think that, you know, a lad's given it the worst ride in the world, but he probably made a decision. As it turned out, it might have been the wrong decision, but at the time he made the decision, it was the best decision he thought he could make at the time.
So have you hung up your riding boots as you still ride out?
I occasionally ride out. I enjoy it, but I wouldn't ride out as much as I used to.
Okay, so you trained point-to-pointers successfully for 15 years. Obviously, there's not much money in the point-to-point sort of for prize money. Is it? Can it be a going concern as a professional trainer?
I'd never set out to make money out of training horses. We'd set out purely to have a bit of fun. And then one or two people asked us to train horses for them. And even back then, it was never about making money. It was actually just because we wanted to do something that we all enjoyed doing. And it gave us a great buzz. And I can honestly say the most fun we had probably was point-to-pointing. I mean, point-to-pointing, it's quietly changed over the years. We're very lucky down here that it's very strong. But win or lose, there was always somebody at a point-to-point who'd say, never mind, come on, let's go and have a drink. And there's, you know, the boots of cars was fully brim full with booze and picnics. And, you know, I think you've got a really good race day experience. Admittedly, it might be in a force 9 gale, but, you know, we had a lot of fun. And because you knew everybody as well, all the trainers, the jockeys, a lot of the owners, you did have a good experience. Whereas if you go for one at Utoxeter, as lovely as Utoxeter is, and you meet your own, it can be very insular. And for them, it's quite insular, which is why I think it's important that I go, because if you're not careful, they can sit in the owners and trainers, they won't see anybody they know. They might strike up a conversation with somebody, but there's nobody, if it goes wrong, to say, come on, why don't we go to the bar and have a drink? So I loved the pointing. As a business, it was never a money-making business.
Okay, so you went professional in 2007. How big a leap was that?
We had a couple of nights, well, Gone to Lunch, really, and a couple of others that we thought were a bit better than your average point-to-pointer. And, yeah, we saw it as a way of maybe getting a horse to reach its potential. So that was probably the main driver. But also at the time, farming was, I don't say struggling, but I mean it was getting harder every year to make money farming, and the government were keen for us to get out and set up other businesses. So we thought, well, maybe we could set up another business that could help supplement the farming.
And so you mentioned Gone to Lunch. That was a good kickstart for your train. Got you noticed as a trainer.
He was a great horse, and he was the first horse that we'd actually gone and bought at the sales that had actually cost a little bit of money. I think it was 15,000. I mean, not mega money, but he proved to be a very useful horses. And actually, we were, in a way, we were spoilt, because we got to go to a lot of the big days. He won some lovely races, but we were, you know, second twice in Scottish National, and, you know, we've never managed to have a horse good enough to run in the Scottish National since then. So we had some lovely experiences with him.
Okay, so a year later, you sold the dairy herd, which I assume is, as you've explained already, you know, sort of diversifying, and the existing facilities were developed to cope with the extra horses. Did you take a punt, or did you sort of know you were going to get support in advance from owners?
We knew there was a reasonable amount of support from owners, but you never, funnily enough, year to year, you never quite know what's going to happen. But we felt we had enough to be able to, I don't say make a financial go of it, because we still had the farm, and the farm, you know, the farm's much scaled back now, but, you know, we were still able to hopefully generate a profit from the farm. So, you know, whilst the training wasn't in any way subsidising the farming, it was beginning to build up. So it was, you know, we could see a way forward if it continued to go the way it went was going. But I mean, in a way, the cows gave us up, because the way that farming went and where we live, you know, the constraints. It wasn't that I didn't want to milk cows anymore, although obviously the racing was more interesting. I'd done cows for 25, 30 years. You know, it was nice to take up a new challenge, and I think that was a healthy thing for us all to do, was to have a new challenge.
And did many of your point-to-point owners make the transition to rules along with you?
Yeah, several did. A lot of people, I think, point-to-point owners struggle when it comes to the handicap system. You know, point-to-pointing is all done on a sort of weight for age. The more races you win, the further up the grade of race you go. So to a point, they always went to the races knowing that they had a good chance, or maybe not, of winning. Whereas, and you know, we had Southwestern, who won, I can't remember, 29 races or 28 races, I think, most of which were point-to-points. But when you went to the open race with him, by and large, he was the best horse in the race, and you could win races. If he were running in handicaps, you know, I think if we'd managed to win 10 races in his career, you'd be doing well if you to win 10 handicaps in a horse's lifetime, because it is the handicapper's job to get you beaten eventually. So I think point-to-point people struggled with that concept and actually became quite disillusioned quite quickly with that. But some of them have stuck with it, and they understand the system better. And certainly the financial rewards, if you do have one that's quite good, are, you know, it does help to pay the bills.
And are you still involved with pointing in any aspect yourself?
Much less so. My daughter Laura used to ride, and that kept us going for several years. My wife trains a couple of pointers for owners that we've had for years, just to keep the interest going. But it's not, it's not a major part of the business at all now.
Okay, so the you're now an established trainer. What have been your most memorable or happiest sort of achievement so far?
I think Gone to Lunch, we had so much fun with that. The first horse we had, which actually I did in association with Chris Popham back in the day, was a little mare called Purple Patch. She didn't win very many, but she was so consistent. But we had some fantastic days with that. But I think Gone to Lunch was what he managed to achieve. And then Melodic Rendezvous, obviously, he was a great flag bearer for us. Winning the Tollworth, obviously, was a great day. But, I mean, he had a season, that following season, where we won the Kingwell, the Elite, and the big champion hurdle trial at Haydock. I mean, he had a fantastic time then. And for a horse who actually was incredibly unsound, and that was, in the end, was his undoing, was, you know, he had terrible knees. I think we'd have struggled to have achieved any more with him. He obviously had ability, but he didn't actually have the physique to go with it, which was a frustration. But on the other hand, I think we got the best out of him. And Unison was, it was lovely to take a horse. It was our first, I think, flat winner. Take a horse off the flat and win flat races with him, and then turn him into a really pretty near top flight hurdler. You know, I think he was, you know, he was a great horse for us.
Okay, you mentioned the flat. You've been a licensed flat trainer since 2016. So apart from the obvious, how does training flat horses differ from jumpers?
I mean, pretty much we don't change too much. I mean, look, we're not training two-year-olds, but the sort of flat horses we've had have probably been racing already on the flat. And, you know, one of the things when Unison won, and I think it was George Baker jumped off it, and he said, it's so nice to ride a flat horse that's actually fit. You know, the one thing I think we're able to do is get horses fit, which maybe sometimes some of the flat trainers, they're concentrating so much on speed that maybe the fitness isn't there. So, I mean, yeah, pretty much we train them the same way, probably not quite to the same intensity as some of the jumpers, but, you know, the worst thing about the flat for us is our location. You know, you've got Bath, Salisbury, Chepstow, and everything else is miles away. So, you know, I can't see us getting too big into the flat. But having said that, God, wouldn't it be lovely to have a staying flat horse that you could hoik grand to those cup races? You know, it would be another, you know, I'm a great believer that if you keep doing something too long, you need a stimulus to try and keep your life enriched. So to try and take the step and train some better flat horses would be a great step to try and take. But obviously we'd need the backing to go with it.
Okay, now when I told a few of my punting mates that I was interviewing Jeremy Scott, and to a man they said, oh, he knows the time of day. Now, would you say you know the time of day when it comes to placing your horses and backing them, maybe?
Well, I don't think we're the worst people at getting things right. Look, we all make mistakes. But I think, you know, by and large, if you see one of our horses run, it'll be fit. Most of the time, it'll be in the right races. There are always reasons why you don't run in the right races. Lack of available opportunities, maybe an owner just physically doesn't want to go somewhere. So we're in the entertainment industry in terms of what we do with our horses, because ultimately we have a boss in terms of our owner, and it is their ultimate decision where horses run. And quite often it's a frustration that you run somewhere where, I mean, particularly when you run one in the same race as another horse, it might be the only available race for the next 3 weeks. So it's not, you know, there are times where I could place them better to win a race, but within the, you know, confines of what we have and the people that we work for, you know, you have to be sensitive as to their wishes. You can't ride roughshod over them just for my advantage rather than theirs.
So would a lot of your time be spent being nosing in the form book to try and find the right races?
I think between all of us, you know, Camilla, Laura and myself, we spend a long time going through it. The right races for a lot of the horses stand out. You can pick out the perfect race. But very often it's at Carlisle or Ayr, which is, and you know, for a five grand pot, isn't really worth going to. So yeah, there are compromises to be made, but you know, we spend plenty of time searching.
So would you say that is betting a part of the yard?
It's not part of my life. It's, and most of my owners would not be gambling people. I've always taken the view that if you're an owner, then you don't want to have a trainer who you're not quite sure is running the horse for you. because he might be doing it for his own pocket. And you know, when you're training a horse for somebody, it's a huge amount of money they're entrusting to you. Not just the value of the animal, but the actual monthly outgoings are huge. And I think it's my job to make sure that I'm doing that to the best of my ability and also in the most honest way I can. So I feel that if I'm the one that's doing the gambling, the only way I could do that would be on my own horses. And so not on somebody else's who's paying the training fees.
So would it put you under huge pressure if a known big gambling owner wanted to send you a horse?
I would train it in the same way that I would train everybody else's. I mean, you obviously if they want to gamble on their horse, that's up to them, and I will do my best to get it in a position that it can win a race or the race. But you know, I've got to do it within the rules of racing and my own conscience. So you know, look, I you know, of course I don't, but I'm not, you know, I've got to do it within the rules.
Now arguably you take even bigger gambles because you go to the sales and buy horses. Is it done on spec, or do you go as
pretty much? I very rarely would get an order for a young horse. If I go to a horses in training sale, then I'd more likely have an order for a horse. But I like to buy a few young horses every year, and be patient with them. I think the pressure to buy a three-year-old, have it run in the spring as a four-year-old, for an owner who's spent a lot of money, is not necessarily doing the horse the biggest favour. To me, the only point of doing that is to sell the horse if somebody wants to make money on a horse. But I'd rather buy a horse, give it time, run it when it's ready. And if I'm in the fortunate position that I've got a farm, I can buy it, do a bit with it, put it away, bring it out, you know, train it again and get it to a point where I know I can sell it to an owner and it'll be prepared and ready to go and win a race. I'd rather do that than, I don't know. I think you can be put on an awful lot of pressure if somebody spent a lot of money on a horse to get a result with it, which in the long term isn't for the benefit of the horse.
And do you have a type? Do you know what you're looking for? Or do you...
I mean, they do come in all shapes and sizes sometimes, but you're just looking for something that's athletic, looks to have the right temperament, and pedigree is obviously important. But I mean, we're never in a position to be able to buy the really flash pedigrees. Type is far more important in that case.
Is it, talking of owners, is it a worry to you that across the industry, owners tend to be of the older demographic, and do you think that maybe young people should be targeted more? Is that not the case with your owners?
Well, I think Trump's a lot of pressure on young people. They've got a lot more pressure on their finances, haven't they? But look, we've got some relatively young owners in the yard. They have a huge amount of fun, and hopefully they'll stay with us and grow with the job. But in the I think it is, you know, if people have got kids and mortgages, you know, you're probably only in a position to own a horse later on in life. But I mean, that's where these syndicates have come in, ownership groups. You know, it does give the opportunity for youngsters to get a bit of an interest in the racing. But I think what we've got to do more is not so much enthuse people to get into racehorse ownership, because I think that's a long-term goal, but I think we have to get young people racing, get them enjoying racing and appreciating maybe some of the subtler bits of racing that you know, it's one thing to go to festival and spend your day in the bar, but it's actually another thing to actually go and have a look at a horse in the paddock and go and see it on the race course and actually really appreciate what a horse is capable of doing and what the jockeys are able to show, and really get to understand racing. So I think that's what we've got to really engage with the young to do, you know.
And you mentioned syndicates. Do you actively encourage syndicates and racing clubs ownership in the yard?
Yeah, I mean, I've you know, we have put together several syndicates, and as I say, it's a great way into racing without a huge financial burden. But what I find harder it, if you're going to go into racehorse ownership, the important bit is the ownership, because I've often found where we've maybe leased an animal that they don't actually feel part of that animal, and I think there does seem to be it's much better for people to actually physically have a stake in it rather than an interest, where I think sometimes the racing clubs don't work that well, because your commitment is relatively so small, you don't actually really feel part of it, and it's quite difficult to get that to work.
Okay, last couple of questions. What would you say, problems, don't be negative, but problems facing racehorse trainers and problems facing racing itself, pet hates of yours?
My biggest pet hate is it's non-stop. I think and I know it sounds a bit old boyish, but back in the day where racing had a start and a finish, or National Hunt Racing had a start and a finish, sort of finished Stratford after the Hunter Chase evening, and then it started up in sort of August with Newton Abbott. And I think that it's unfortunately having jump racing all year round is, I'm sure mentally it's not good for trainers and jockeys. I think having a proper break allows people to top back up. Not just us, but the staff as well. We've got a problem with staff retention. I think we've got to give people a break. After all, that's what flat racing's for. Flat racing during the summer, no shortage of flat horses to run. If we compressed our season a little bit either end of the summer, and just give us a bit more of a break. But I think there's an awful lot of good in racing. I mean, I think, you meet the most fabulous people in racing. One or two rogues, but they're interesting in their own right. You know, we are so privileged to be in a sport that there's huge camaraderie in. We can have a huge amount of fun with dealing with animals that I think are just outstanding to deal with. And a horse that gives its all, that's quite something, isn't it? So I think there's a huge amount of good in racing. I think, we could all moan about leadership from the top, and there are bits and pieces, obviously, we'd like to tweak around. But, I think if we can foster an appreciation of the animal and the people that we're dealing with, then we're it's a sport of kings, and I think we're lucky to be involved in it.
And finally, any burning ambitions that you've really got your sights set on?
It's always improving the quality of horse in the yard and being able to compete at the higher level. I mean, we were lucky enough to go over to the Punchestown Festival, which I think is just the most fabulous festival. I mean, Cheltenham's great, don't get me wrong, but you have a huge amount of fun over in Punchestown, and it would be nice to have horses capable of competing, obviously at the top meetings, but also to take us on a journey abroad, see other parts of racing. I think it's constantly to just widen our net in terms of what we're able to do. So and of course I want to have Cheltenham winners and win a Grand National, all this kind of thing that every trainer would love to do. But I think it's just the experience of going, seeing new things, taking on new challenges. That's where we're looking forward.
Okay, we'll be watching with interest. Jeremy Scott, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Johnny Ward presents The Front Runner in association with starsports.bet. 18 and over. Be gamble aware.